This morning, wind from the west at 12, gusted to 18, 31 degrees Kenosha, 30 degrees in Racine, wind chill stands at 16. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
To the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy to be sitting opposite two faculty colleagues from Carthage College to talk about a very special event that is coming up later this week. In fact, one aspect of this special symposium is actually already open to the public. The symposium is called Beauty in Expression, a Visual and Performing Arts Symposium. And it centers around an extraordinary collection of Soviet-era art that has been donated to Carthage and that is on exhibit before the public between now and the 29th of January. And towards the end of that period is this symposium, which features some special events coming up a little later this week, primarily Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Here to talk about all of this is, first of all, Dr. Corinne Ness, who is Dean of the Division of Arts and Humanities at Carthage. She also directs the Graduate Studies Program at Carthage in Musical Theater, and she has been one of the primary movers and shakers and shapers of this particular event behind the scenes. And also joining us is Dr. Jojen Van Winkle, who is Assistant Professor of Art at Carthage and also Program Director for the Photography and Film and New Media Program. And she'll be offering some of her thoughts not only on the Soviet-era art exhibit that is already showing at Carthage in the Art Gallery, but also talking about a really special film-related aspect to this symposium. Again, it is called Beauty in Expression, and all of the events we're going to be talking about, we want to emphasize, are free and open to the public. So, Dr. Corinne Ness and Dr. Jojen Van Winkle, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg.
So, Corinne Ness, we were just briefly reminiscing about how long it's been since you've been on the morning show.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners roughly how long it has been and what you were talking about the last time you were here.
Yeah, so 19 years ago, I was on here with you to talk about Carthage's production of The Fantastics. It was the first musical at Carthage that I was the stage director for at the time, and we brought some of our students, Trevor Parker, who was one of your voice students. And I remember it because I had said yes right before that when I had my first son, Max. And so that's exactly how many years ago he was born. And so advice to the listeners, never say yes to things when you've just given birth. Maybe I should have waited a little longer. But usually really exciting projects come out of the craziness of yes. And so this project, too, is also one of those things where several years ago we started thinking about what if we were to receive a donation like this and what could be part of it. And so this is a Soviet era symposium is a little bit of those other kind of crazy yeses of let's try it. What else could this become?
Right. So let's say yes and see what happens, what ensues. Very good. Well, it's great to have you back. I can't believe it's been 19 years, but that's it's great to have you back.
Thanks.
And Jojen Van Winkle, you have been on the morning show one previous occasion under very different circumstances in which you were not in the studio at all. Explain what our previous morning show conversation was about.
Oh, yes. That was in the heart of the pandemic. I was speaking along with some of my colleagues, our chair of our art department, Kimberly Green, and also Ryan Miller. We weren't all together. We were separately, I think, Zooming in mm-hmm. and the recording. And we were talking about teaching during the pandemic, and in particular, how do you teach visual hands-on art, and what does that look like for our students, whether the work is digital or whether it's trying to teach ceramics from, you know, from afar. And so that was, we were talking about our successes because our students really did succeed and go beyond our expectations at that time.
Great feeling, isn't
yes.
it? And it's interesting to think back to not all that long ago, how drastically differently we were having to do the things that we'd done in commonplace ways for such a long time. So I really enjoyed that conversation, and I'm really happy that you're back. So, Karine Ness, tell our listeners a little bit more about this, what you kind of hinted at in terms of this intriguing possibility that you ultimately decided Carthage needed to say yes to, whatever that meant.
Yeah, so several years ago, we were presented with the possibility of there might be an opportunity to receive this donation, a very large collection. There's about 131 pieces in it of Soviet-era artwork and what that might mean. And very early on, the administration and I were in conversations about how if we were to do something like this, we didn't want to just hold it in an appropriate space to keep it as an asset, but if it were really going to be an asset to Carthage, that we needed to think about how we would engage with it, how we would engage scholars and learners and the community with it, and what would that look like. So we started a few years ago with some faculty on a committee along with some staff to try to think about what could it look like if we were to plan for something really unique and exciting. So we started talking about the uniqueness of Carthage is J term, and how unlike some schools that just do a February is or all the way up to February is fall, and then you do your spring semester, we have this January J term where you really only do one class and you immerse yourself in it. So we thought about, well, what would it look like if we were to have something immersive around this collection? And that immersive also meant, you know, opening up wider conversations, not just about what you see in the gallery, but what other kind of experiences can you have? So thinking about culture writ large, what would that look like to think about collecting, and what would that look like to think about the music of the time, and to think about history and film? And so we sort of started dreaming about all the different things that could come together. And then, of course, a year ago, we were approached with the offer and went through all of the paperwork and things that happen when you accept a donation of that kind. And so we said, well, then the first one will be January 2023. And here we are.
I think it would be helpful for our listeners to have you unwrap the term symposium. And, of course, it's on all the posters and so on. And it's a term that the three of us use fairly often, along with a lot of our colleagues at Carthage. But for the general public, I'm not sure that term has a whole lot of resonance. And they especially might not understand the context in which it's being used. So explain what a symposium is in general, and then more specifically, what this symposium is going to be.
Sure. Now I'm wishing I looked it up on Google Dictionary first, but I'm going to tell you how we've been using it in practice. And so the idea of gathering a conference of ideas around a particular set of works or something like that. So the idea of this symposium is to look at this beautiful artwork that really came out of a very oppressive regime. And how were these artists sustaining themselves as artists under that regime, but also how were they able to continue to make art? So what art did they create that was for an oppressive regime? And then what art did they use the leftover paint for and hide under their bed because it was so subversive and things like that? And so we really tried to lean into that idea of what does it look like to create beauty under those circumstances. So the idea of the symposium was to look at that question from a number of different ways. So there there is the exhibit itself in the art gallery, but then there are also these special events that are designed to engage with those questions. And so on Thursday evening, we are showing a documentary film that is sort of, Jojen will talk more about it, but it's sort of everyday setting in Odessa and some other areas. And so looking at how monumental that work was and what techniques were used to create during that time. And we have a guest documentary filmmaker, and then having a curator come who's helped curate this first exhibition, but she'll be doing a talk. Dr. Zavialova is an anthropologist by training. So her talk really is meant to unpack those ideas and those cultural understandings. And then on Saturday, we're having a concert of a Shostakovich cello sonata with piano that will be introduced, and then also questions afterward with Carthage music history professor Dmitry Shapovalov, who also grew up in St. Petersburg, and then a conversation with a collector, Ray Johnson, one of our Carthage distinguished alums, is a collector and helped start the Russian Museum of Art in Minneapolis. And he's been very involved with the artists during the Soviet era, artists across Eastern Europe, and helping protect this artwork. And so that conversation as well. So those are some of the building blocks. But we're also having visits by the creative writing class will come in and be exploring the work from their context. And Professor Troutwine is bringing his math class to look at patterns and things like that in the artwork. So that's part of the symposium as well, is that different classes will be coming through. There's a peace studies course and Dr. Mitchell's class on Beauty Will Save the World. And so all of these different classes are coming through, thinking about their material through this lens of beauty and expression. So that's sort of how it's all coming together, and trying to get everybody thinking about a really broad topic from their own perspective, but engaging in these materials while they're doing it.
Very good. So this symposium is kind of spokes of a wheel, and it's the spokes come from a lot of different disciplines, but they're all in a sense focused on one pretty juicy topic that really invites a lot of different avenues of exploration. So in that respect, that is what this is. So Jojen van Winkle, just tell us from your perspective as a member of the art faculty, how you kind of greeted the news about this possibility. First of all, the art exhibit itself, but also the possibility of doing other things beyond that.
Well, it's a really unique opportunity to have for Carthage to have this collection of primarily paintings. And these paintings, I think what they offer our students are an opportunity to look at kind of the behind-the-scenes inner workings of work that is older, that it work that is related to realism, work that's related to observation, and pretty deep into different kinds of traditions that are at the heart of a lot of painting, or I would say they're not contemporary painting necessarily, but like the heart of painting. What kinds of things this offers for our students, though, what I mean behind the scenes is that this collection is that they can see these works up close. It's, in fact, like just this last Friday, I went with my students to the Art Institute of Chicago, and I was thinking, well, in our gallery are pieces that are just as old, just as large, with really unique frames, and quite a range of topics available right on campus to see. I think that the collection also potentially has the ability to offer our students to be able to experience the paintings off-site in storage, doing storage visits, so that we can get the angle of something more from art history, preservation, how do you take care of works. We're hoping that at some points we'll be able to incorporate that more into our curriculum. But the exhibit itself offers, I don't think we've since I've been at Carthage, which hasn't been very long, just 5 years now, but the opportunity to see work that is from the late 1880s to the early 1900s is pretty amazing. We mainly show a lot of contemporary art, living artists, so this is very, very different. Mm. And I have to say what has also... There's other sort of spillover effects that are available for our students. Last Saturday, three of our seniors who are studio art majors and also art education majors had their thesis exhibitions in the adjacent space, which is called our VPAL, Visual Performing Arts Laboratory. And you enter that through the gallery. So the effect of that was people who came to see the student exhibitions, their friends, their families, also got to experience the Sylvia era art. Vice versa, we have the public that came because they heard about this show and wanted to see it, and then that they trickled in and got to see the work by our students. So there's a nice symbiotic relationship, not only between those two spaces, but opportunities for the artwork within those spaces to kind of have what I would call a dialogue. You can see, you can definitely see in the Sylvia era paintings a lot of like beautiful use of some of the way color has been used, not only in composition, the formal elements are really grounded in the works. A lot of them have narratives. And in contrast to that, in contemporary art, which is a lot of what our students are doing, their work is grounded in research, so their narrative may be different, may not be something that you see right away, but as you're looking through it, you see formal elements of art. So this dialogue between contemporary and between work that are coming from the early, 20th century to the late 19th century, this kind of space and the ability to be right next to each other is something really unique for our students, for the public that comes. And I think in a way the sky's the limit. I'm not sure what will happen next.
Very exciting. Yeah. For those of you just joining us, we're talking today on the morning show about a very exciting event at Carthage, Beauty in Expression, a visual and performing arts symposium. And kind of the cornerstone of this event is a marvelous collection of well over 100 Soviet-era artworks, paintings largely, that are already on display in the art gallery at Carthage and will be through the end of the month. And so this week, with special events Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, there are other events going on in conjunction with that art exhibit towards that theme of beauty in expression and the creation of beauty in the midst of an oppressive regime, and what is the role that the art we create, be it visual art or music or film, what role does that play? Before we get to some of these other events, Karine Ness, maybe you could say just a little bit more about the nature of this art collection, how it was collected, so to speak, and so on. And a little bit more about kind of the process by which it was donated to Carthage.
Yeah, so the current collection has 131 pieces of work in it, the majority of which are from two really special people to us, Sam and Barry Schoen. They're very involved in collecting, but also in teaching and supporting the arts. And we were connected with them through this distinguished alum, Ray Johnson, who is also a collector in his own right. But one of the things that really struck me when we met with Sam before we had even received this collection, we visited him at his house, and he had these beautiful, giant works of art on his walls. But he was so... he looked at them so deeply and considered them so deeply and, was so thoughtful about that narrative that Jojen was talking about, that these weren't just things that he went, that'd be a good one. They were all part of his family of artworks. And so when we received the donation, that was something that was really important to me, that we make sure we honor that life that they had to him, that we were going to do that as well. So even before before this symposium, we've had one of our studio art and art history majors, Claire, has been doing research on all of them because initially the idea was brought to us as there's a Russian art collection. But as we dug in, we're like, actually, they're not all Russian. We have a large number of Ukrainian and Armenian. Mm. And so one of the very first projects was to begin to dive into that history of this is actually a Soviet era collection, and there are some Russian pieces and some others. So we have the student researcher working with us as well to help us unpack that. And so that education part was so important to Sam and Barry that we wanted to make sure that that continues to live in the work that we're doing. And I felt really heartened because I was outside the gallery waiting for it to be open one day, and one of the students was there with a friend, and he said, "Do you know that there's Russian and Ukrainian art in the gallery?" And it's been really interesting because there's so much going on. And I thought, that's what Ukrainian art looks like. And I was like, well, there we go. And, you know, just a general student, I was like, this is the whole point of having interesting conversations around culture and around aesthetics and art. And the more we do that, the better off we'll be.
Yeah. So, do you know anything about what drew them to want to collect this particular sort of art? Was it driven by anything in terms of their own background or life experience?
No. Sam is not he's not a visual art professor or anything like that. He's done a lot of work through business and other things, and he has a wonderfully long bio that I don't want to mess up. So, but he's had a very active life that way. But just initially saw some and liked it. You know, and so there was a first piece, and then there was a second and a third. And then he decided that rather than working through different collectors and things through the United States, that that he wanted to meet the artist, that he wanted to look at it there. So he worked with an art historian, and he and that art historian would go to the Soviet Union back then and meet with artists and talk to them about their work and to know their families. And wow. Ray Johnson, who's coming this weekend as well, works similarly directly with the artists to support their work and to understand those narratives and the stories behind them. So it really was, it just became this passion project after one then the other. And one of the things that Sam mentioned too, that he has this great love for the how large the pieces are, and not just because it's like, ooh, that's big, but the drama within these pieces is just really striking at that level. And so that was really interesting to me when he would show me the different pieces, that he has great care for those pieces and how they sort of function together. You know, this artist was painting this, and this is the story, but this one, oh, you have to see this one, you know, and very expressive about those. Yeah.
So how many pieces are we talking about that are currently on display in the art gallery? I'm assuming not all 131.
No. Yes, we do not have that large of a gallery.
Right.
There are about 20 pieces that are in the gallery because they are quite large. And then we, along with it, have you can access it through a QR code, a PDF, but we also have copies there that has some of the historical context and information about it, because we wanted to leave all the space on the walls for the art.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
I can say that there are some that are very large. I know there was three of us hanging a few of the pieces. And it's one of the reasons they're not just large, but some are heavy. Mm. They have beautiful, ornate frames on them that are – those in of themselves would be a whole conversation just to talk to somebody who does woodworking. I mean, it just – they're gorgeous.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the process of actually hanging this portion of the collection in the art gallery. And I think for a lot of us that are very much coming at this as amateurs – we might not begin to appreciate just what a task that is. Not only the heavy lifting, literally, in this case, but also just figuring out which 20 pieces and how best to present them in terms of it making some sort of coherent statement. Can you describe kind of the dimensions of that challenge?
Oh, well... I myself was not involved in the selection. There's a curator who selected the works. And then at Carthage, we have a gallery director who's also one of our a faculty member, Professor Ryan Miller. And so Ryan did the installation. I worked with him on a few of the large pieces just because he needed some more hands and also has a gallery assistant, but they were very large. So the process, though, in terms of organizing an exhibition is often that it's the understanding of what's the focus for the show would be one step to have. And then what types of works would you be selecting from? So if it's one artist or in this case, many, many different artists and trying to find a relationship. And so I can't speak for a curator. I'm looking forward to her talk to find out more of what kinds of decisions she was making. But I can see that in the work that's on display, there are relationships between spaces, between like how many figures are even in a composition in the painting and sort of, you know, so that's one thing to take in consideration. Another is just the space itself, what looks good. So sometimes museums or galleries will set up mock displays, so like basically a small diorama, and move little images of the works around until they find the perfect, you know, combination. It just all depends on that, you know, how each space is different, how they do that. What we did need to do in this gallery, though, because we're wanting to show so many of the pieces and how wonderful they are, extra walls are added in the middle that aren't always there, just depends on the show. So that creates more wall space. Some other considerations are just so it's the layout, but then the formal ones. What do you want to have in the beginning? What is there in your exhibit? Is there some kind of point where you have a almost like a climactic moment, like leading the you can't always tell how an audience will move through a show unless there's only one direction and one path.
Right.
But in this gallery, you could go to either side. So your journey may be different than somebody else's that comes into the space. But hopefully, on your journey through the show, you will come to some of those key pieces that the curator was wanting to focus on in terms through the layout.
Very good. Yeah. It's exciting. I mean, just hearing the description makes me very excited to see this with my own eyes. Karine Ness, can you tell us anything more about the pieces that were selected to be part of this? I mean, I assume you had at least some contact with the curator, and is this as simple as just the greatest hits, or more of a it's a case of pieces being selected because they say something that is important for this event?
Yeah, so we met with Dr. Zavialova about a year ago, and she has seen the whole collection in person because we had originally received it up in Minneapolis. One of Ray, our alum, was helping us store it as we decided what were our next paths forward. So she was able to see all of the works. So then when it came time for the planning, because we, of course, invited her to do this, she had a sense of what the pieces were. And we had initially talked a year ago. There were a number of different themes, of course, that we could have pursued. And so we decided intentionally for this first one to really pursue sort of these different sort of epochs of Soviet era art. Mm. So you'll see the very earliest one is almost pre-Soviet, and be able to see a work from then, as well as these later, more severe style pieces. And so in some ways, you can sort of see the major trends across those and some of the major artists as a way of like introducing. We thought it might not be the best thing to focus on something like village scenes because it wouldn't introduce our community enough to this idea of the broader range of it. So once we had determined that theme, then she went through all of the different materials and thinking about color, size, what it would look like. And I do know that she made a little diorama because of the interesting size of our gallery and how large some could be. She really wanted to check and see. So so she sent one and said, hold on, let me, I'm doing this first. So let me double check. And here's just a couple of changes, and then sent it back so that it could really represent the artwork in its highest form.
Fantastic. One of the things you said early on when you were talking about this collection and about just kind of the phenomenon of artists creating art in the midst of this kind of a setting, specifically the Soviet regime, which of course was a difficult setting for the typical artist. You said something that suggested that in some cases artists are really kind of stepping in step with the regime. I mean, and creating art, you know, kind of at the behest of the regime. And then in other cases, creating art that is, in a sense, a form of resistance, even sometimes very much undercover, but nevertheless trying to sort of speak against the regime that is in power and its oppressiveness. So in that respect, is this a collection that represents both of those things?
Yes, and I have to admit in all of this, you did mention at the start, I am a music theater professor, so this is a learning curve for me as well. And I think that's why I've been so taken by it, is that there is so much history and so much information to learn about within it. So it was interesting where I would look at a piece and say, oh, what an interesting scene about orphans. And then Dr. Zavialova would say, well, here is how this is subversive. And I was like, like I never, you know, it seemed to me like that would be one where saying, look at how good and kind the government is. And so that context of her anthropological background really helps understand, here's what was happening. Here's how they made it look as if they were supporting that. But look, notice this detail and notice the way that this is being handled there and think about space. And so that was really striking to me, how something could really be considered on those two planes at the same time, as opposed to this is propaganda and this is protest art, but like within the same one, that you could consider both those things. So that's been really exciting to me to be able to dive into and learn more and more about that, to read books. I've been lucky enough to have a lot of different books that help explain sort of the context of all that. So I'm reading a lot, and I'm hoping that when other people see this exhibition, they're going to be just as taken and want to check out the books in the library, or, you know, I've been on podcasts and all sorts of things, because it really is so striking.
Wow. And Jojen van Winkle, I should think, as an art professor, that has to be music to your ears. I mean, because that's, of course, what all of this is about. It's on one hand, it is, as you've already said, is very much about sharing something really special with your art students. But on the other hand, it's also about the way this kind of art can speak to all kinds of people and get all kinds of people excited.
It is very exciting. And I mean, I think that Dines hit it on the head there with the idea that if some very powerful kinds of work is really does multiple things at once. And artists often, if you're doing something that's like a commission, which would be in this case for the government or the state, so say you had a commissioned piece, how can you, and depending on where you align with that commission, what of yourself can you bring to that? And you can bring all kinds of things. You can bring things that are joyful, right? You can also bring things that challenge a system. And so this idea of these ideas in art, I think, add to the complexity of not only for the creator to bring some of themselves into something, probably, I imagine, brings a lot of laughs with their friends if they're looking at it as well. But also it allows them to speak their mind and have personal freedom. And I think that is that element of personal freedom, personal expression, being able to involve the core of whoever you are as an artist into your work is important. And then add the layer of having to work within whatever system someone's commissioning you to do something for. How do you do that? And what's the intent? And I think you can see this happening. This concept is—it's not gone away. It's in an art of all kinds. That's how we get layered meanings. It happens in films. It happens in photographs. I can't speak for music, but I imagine that in other art forms that this is also happening. And this is how we create the ability to not only be present in the culture that we live in, but also to comment on it, to comment in the sense of it could be directing to where change needs to happen, where change could happen, or just the fact of different kinds of things, heartache, suffering, and how do you point to that while still doing what it is that you need to do with your art. I don't know all the circumstances behind every single piece that was created for this exhibition, but I imagine there was a lot of artists that had to find ways to negotiate in their lives in all kinds of circumstances. And so, and that's something that, you know, we do today as well.
I also just want to add, too, that we're talking about how joyful and all these layered meanings. And I also have to say, there's just really beautiful artwork. So there's one piece I'm so taken with. It's an elderly grandma, and she has a head covering on that just reminds me of the babushka my Polish grandmother wore. And she's feeding some food to these younger girls. And it just reminds me of my older sister and I at my grandmother's table. And so I stand before it a lot just because I keep thinking, that's grandma and grandma's table. So even those moments, like it can be complicated, but it also, in many ways, I was surprised at how deeply personal it can feel, even within all of that. So don't be frightened.
Right. So, so even apart from the kind of weighty, substantive matters that we're talking about, like political regimes and artistic statements and so on, I mean, that is part of this story, but that's not the whole story. It's also about just artwork that's beautiful to look at.
There's a still life that's also really gorgeous, several, but there's one that's also really, really beautiful, and it's the kind of piece that you might not even need to know what country it's from just to enjoy the elements and the compositional choices that the artist made, and probably many people would see it and could see that in their own homes.
Wow. So we want to just remind everybody that this art exhibit is already on display in the H.F. Johnson Gallery of Art on the campus of Carthage now through the 29th of January. And in the meantime, this coming Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, there is going to be a curator's talk by this guest curator who is, again, an anthropologist, so bringing kind of an interesting array of areas of expertise to curating this particular collection. So that presentation, again, is Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock in the recital hall, and a special gala reception after that, which I assume is open to the public, or is that invitation only? Okay. And all of that. And then, Corinne, briefly, we have a lot of other things to talk about, but we've touched briefly on this conversation with a collector that's coming up on Saturday afternoon, which I happen to be involved with. But I wonder if you could explain a little further about who Ray Johnson is and, in a sense, his connection to all of this.
Ray is one of Carthage's distinguished alums. He won that award several years ago. He has a really early connection to Kenosha. He went to Carthage when it was in Carthage, Illinois, and the president at the time was trying to bring students and make inroads with families and communities in Kenosha as, you know, sort of a bridge as we were going to move north here. And so Ray was sent in the president's car to travel north and sing some songs. He sang in the Carthage choir, and so he would come sing some songs in their front rooms and get to know people. And that getting to know people and that connection, I think, pervades everything Ray has ever done in his life. He's really a people person and a connector. And that led to, sort of skipping a lot of things in between, to his work in running the Overland Gallery in Minneapolis, which is a very large gallery where he works with people who are interested in purchasing art. And so he has his own collection of Soviet art, but and other types of Russian art and other art in general. But he also knows a number of people who are collectors who also might have goals at certain points in their life to donate those to places that will caretake for them. And so Ray's been a connector that way. And so since this is the inaugural symposium, we thought it would be really interesting to talk with someone who made a life with this idea of collecting and caretaking for this kind of art. So we thought it would be nice to invite him back to hear that story and have our students sort of hear about what's that like as well.
Fantastic. So that's going to be Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, also in the recital hall, a conversation with a collector again, Ray Johnson. So we have yet to touch in any detail on a couple of other elements to this visual and performing arts symposium at Carthage called Beauty and Expression. And one of them occurs Thursday evening with the screening of a film. A film called A Man with a Movie Camera, a documentary. So, Jojane Van Winkle, tell us a little bit more about this film and how beautifully it folds into the proceedings.
This film, well, I hope everybody listening will get a chance to come or watch this at some point. A Man with a Movie Camera is a quintessential film that relates to montage. And a montage is a type of technique that grew out of Soviet-era filmmaking. And so just to touch on a couple things, that this particular film, it's unique in several aspects. One is it's a self-reflexive film, which means it's a film that is a documentary film. It's set in several cities in Moscow and Kyiv and also Odessa. And it shows a filmmaker making a film. It also shows the filmmaking process. And so the filmmaker, Dziga Vertov, he is directed it. He's in it. His spouse edited it. And you also see her editing in it as well. Hmm. And so this film is multi-layered and probably in our contemporary mind, in a way, something that's self-reflexive is sort of normal to us when we have a lot of things that are meta in our lives. Yeah. But this was truly unique. You know, people were doing this
back in 1929,
and so it's a black and white film, and in terms of other important aspects to it, it has a lot of filmmaking techniques that then began to be incorporated in other areas as well. So if you were to almost like see it, this were the only film you were to ever see, it would show you so many different kinds of techniques. Not only things that we visually, because we're a visual culture and many of us look at videos, watch, stream things, watch things on our phones, but the language of cinema is embedded in this film. So you have things like split screen, where you have two images at once. You have things like match on action, where you're going from one scene to the other, so something's a match cut. So either match on action, match on content, match on movement. You have tracking shots, so the camera is going alongside the person as they're moving. You have shots where extreme close-ups, which, you know, is really monumental. Now, other artists and filmmakers in the 1920s in Europe were also doing these kinds of things, like Man Ray, Salvador Dali, Louis Bunuel were also making films at the late 20s. So there's a little bit of, you know, crossover. But what's also extremely interesting about this is that it is a feature-length film, and it takes you through, like, the life of the day and life of a city. Even though it's shot in different cities, it's like the life of one city. So they call this type of film a symphony, a city symphony. Hmm. And so I thought of that because we have this symposium, right, that has to do also with music and visual arts. And so the work in of itself is kind of this embodiment of bringing together so many different parts. It also, what I personally think is really amazing is to see this documentary footage and to see how people were living in 1929 in these hustling and bustling cities and what's happening in their lives. So you become attached to the character of this cameraman moving through these spaces, but you get glimpses into how other people are existing, what the cars look like, what they're wearing, what factories look like. There's a lot of everyday normalness, I would say, in this kind of work. Vertov was, that's what he wanted. He wanted to make cinema that wasn't for the Borghese. It wasn't a fairy tale. This is what he thought fictional film was. And so he wanted to make something that was about the here and now. And he was also really concerned about this film coming out. He's from a group of artists that wrote a lot of manifestos about why realism and documentary work was so important at that time in the Soviet Union. And so he was very concerned about how this film was going to be perceived. And it's had such longevity. I mean, I'm sure if he were around today, he would be really pleased with how well it's still doing. I'm just excited that we're going to be able to show this on the big screen. And I think that right now I'm teaching a J-term class that's on experimental film and video. And so we've been learning to work with Premiere Pro and doing editing and doing digital things. And then after this, we're going to start working a little bit in celluloid film, as I like to say, like the old-timey stuff. And so I'm excited for them to see this film.
Well, and for them to see this kind of innovation being done in 1929, and back in a time when I think a lot of us would never even assume that documentaries existed at all. I mean, we just don't think of that as being part of the film industry in that early period, and of course it was, and this is probably the single most noteworthy example of it. So
yeah, and he actually, this filmmaker, he comes from a background of shooting newsreels, and that's where a lot of documentary footage grew out of after the First World War, being able to have cameras that were more, even more portable and even more accessible, and the importance of the newsreel to communicate to the world before you went and saw your fictional film what else was going on in the world. And so this particular filmmaker, that's some of his grounding of how he came into making.
Wonderful. So this film is going to be screened in the Campbell Student Union Auditorium. So this is on the upper floor of the Student Union, the movie theater there, Thursday evening, the 26th of January, 7 p.m. And again, completely free, open to the public. And a guest speaker, Jeremy Workman, who is an Emmy-nominated documentary filmmaker, is going to be on hand to speak about the film and answer questions. So that is Thursday night. Mm-hmm. Last and certainly not least, Corinne, take just a very, very short amount of time, I'm afraid, to talk about the performance Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock of the Shostakovich Cello Sonata, and say a word about how beautifully this also fits into all that we've been talking about.
Yeah, and so as a music professor, we could not do this symposium without a music event. And so when I reached out to our music department chairs to say, you know, what do you think we could do to connect to this? Dr. Shapovalov immediately said, what about the Shostakovich Cello Sonata? And I was like, yes, that's absolutely perfect for this. And we're lucky to have cellist Peter Thomas, who is a Carthage cello instructor for us, but also with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra and does a number of other performances across Milwaukee. So very well known for his work. And he'll be collaborating with Matthew Beggy, who is also a known piano collaborator in the Milwaukee area. So what's exciting, so it's a 30-minute work. So it's exciting just to be able to have that happen live. You don't usually get to hear that piece. But what I think is even more cool about it is that Dr. Shapovalov will be there to sort of introduce the piece, then we'll be able to hear it and then talk about it a little afterwards. And I don't think we do that enough in the musical arts. We experience something and then we go away and talk about it, but it's really nice to have the opportunity to speak with a musicologist, speak with the performers about the piece, about the historical context, and how we're going to hear that through the music itself. And so that recital will be about 1 hour, so people could come to that and then enjoy the artwork and then hear the conversation and have some snacks. It could be a whole afternoon out.
Sounds perfect. So if people are curious about anything that we have talked about today, the art exhibit, the film screening, this musical performance, the special presentations, is all this information in one place readily available?
It is. If you go to the Carthage website, which is www.carthage.edu, if you go into the search bar and just type in symposium, we're the first one that will come up. So you can go right to the webpage that will list all of the events. There's links to some of the photos. There's links to the PDF for the gallery presentation, to the bios of our guests. If for some reason you can't find that, you could also just email me directly. It's cness@carthage.edu, and I will send you the links and anything else you need.
Fantastic. This is so exciting, and it's really kind of a one-of-a-kind event, although it might also be the first of a number of similar events, but really Carthage has not seen anything quite like this before, so it's exciting to be able to talk about it. Beauty in Expression, a Visual and Performing Arts Symposium on the campus of Carthage. All the events we've talked about today, free and open to the public. And my guests today, Dr. Corinne Ness, Dean of the Division of Arts and Humanities at Carthage, and JoJan Van Winkle, Assistant Professor of Art and Program Director for the Photography and Film and New Media Program. Thank you so much for helping to spread the word about this great event.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Jack Rose joins us from the Kenosha County chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, to talk about new efforts underway to secure more beds in Kenosha for mental health care. Also, the CEO of the Build-A-Bear Workshop talks about her lovely book called Stories and Heart. Thursday, regrettably, Carthage professor Ron Kronovich has had to cancel his scheduled appearance on the program. So in its place, the author of a book called The Middle Place, Kelly Corrigan, a well-known journalist and podcast host, but a very personal book about her battle with cancer.